At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What happens when that retail therapy purchase wasn't quite what you wanted and when actual therapy needs go unmet? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Wednesday, December the 29th. Good to have you with us. With the boom in online shopping from either the holiday season or just during the pandemic in general, comes a boom in online returns. Optoro, which manages returns for companies like Target, IKEA, and American Eagle, says consumers will send back $120 billion worth of goods between Thanksgiving and the end of January. It's an expensive process for retailers that's becoming an even bigger problem with rising shipping costs and fewer workers to process returns. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more.
Maybe your grandparents or in-laws gave you an ugly sweater this holiday. Lucky you. If you bring it back to the store, it's easy for the retailer. You do the legwork, they put it on the shelf.
Now, if it's an item that you buy online, the vast majority of them actually don't go back to shelf.
Tobin Moore is CEO of Optoro. He says online returns take up to 2 months to go back into inventory. And by then, that ugly sweater is out of season. So it's put on clearance, sold to a reseller, or
they'll just toss it, because that's the most economical solution for them.
As online shopping grows, so does the returns problem. Because David Sobey, co-founder of Happy Returns, a software and logistics company, says more people are using their bedroom as a dressing room. More than 30% of online apparel purchases are sent back.
Now, we've all probably experienced buying multiple sizes of something with the intent of returning the item that doesn't fit best.
It's why retailers are using services like Happy Returns, which hosts drop-off locations to batch items and cut down on shipping costs and time. Other strategies include increasing the cost of products, adding a restock fee, or letting the customer keep the item because it costs less. Sucharita Kadali, a retail analyst at Forrester, says there's no perfect fix.
It's just sort of one of the things that you have to do to be competitive in the retail world.
Because she says though the cost of online returns to the retailer is high, the value of that service to the customer is even greater. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
In addition to returns, another thing that happens around this time of year is lots of folks making resolutions for the new year. And many of those ambitious goals for 2022, of course, require yet another shopping trip. Or at least retailers hope so. There's a whole economy tied up in New Year's resolutions, but with COVID yet again throwing a wrench in our best laid plans, is anyone still in the mood to pay for self-improvement? Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
There's this concept in marketing called the fresh start effect. Basically, if you just buy this Thighmaster or self-help book, you can be a newer, better version of you. Omicron makes fresh starts a tougher sell this new year, says Grant Donnelly, a marketing professor at Ohio State.
There probably is some sort of consumer resentment or kind of pessimism around, you know, believing of what might be possible.
Still, he expects a New Year's bump for some pandemic-friendly brands. Donnelly wants to spend more quality time with friends in 2022. So instead of buying Scattergories for game night, he's looking into
Jackbox. It's like a virtual gaming system that allows you to connect with people.
Households often sort out their finances for New Year's, says Leanna DeVinny, a financial planner with Fidelity, a marketplace underwriter. She says financial goals for 2022 may be tied with another pandemic trend, quitting.
I had clients who said, you know, being home, I wanted to do a career change.
Shashi Belamconda's big goal for 2021 was travel. He hoped he'd be spending this holiday season in India. That never happened. He just tested positive for COVID this week. He's feeling okay, isolating in his home in Maryland.
No, I'm not making resolutions. The only resolution people should make is to get vaccinated and boosted.
Belamconda does think 2022 will feel more normal, but he's not buying plane tickets just yet. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Just a couple of trading days left in the year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Making resolutions for the new year might feel weird when it seems like, at least when it comes to where we are in the pandemic, a lot of what we're going through is distressingly similar to last year. Even though a lot of things are meaningfully better than they were last year, the dragging on of the pandemic can make it difficult to see that forward progress, especially with many of us still reeling from illness or loss of a loved one, a job, or just our old way of life. This time last year, I spoke with psychotherapist Megan Devine about grieving the old economy, and we gave her a call to see how things have changed since then. Megan Devine, it's good to talk to you again.
Again. I wish this was under better circumstances, but I am, regardless, glad to be back.
When we spoke a year ago, you said that we, as a country, were getting better at acknowledging loss, but you stopped short of saying that we were better at grieving. Where do you think we are now?
I think the acknowledgement wave is spreading.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with it, I think we've made some progress, but I certainly don't think we've turned the ship around quite yet.
And what are the consequences of not having made it to that next step?
Ooh, that's a good one. So this sort of aversion to telling the truth about grief shows up in suicidality, addiction, loneliness, depression. It shows up in pretty much every social or cultural sphere. So many things will start to improve when we start to really tell the truth about grief and what helps and what doesn't.
You mentioned that it shows up in sort of our social and cultural interactions, but it's also showing up at work.
Yeah, the impacts of not just grief related to death, but sort of that broad sweep of how hard it is to be human in a lot of different ways. I mean, we've got morale issues, certainly huge morale issues in certain industries. Also, you know, sick days or the economic toll of depression. I was thinking about how that sort of flips the script on how we think about the impacts of mental health and wellness on the economy or on the business world. We think like we need people to be happy, healthy, productive members of society to improve the bottom line. And actually the reverse is true in my experience, that the more we allow the full breadth of human emotionality, so not just happy and productive, the more that we sort of apply skill to human interpersonal relationships and grief and loss, the ramifications of overhauling the way that we understand the human emotional reality and how we deal with it, the ripple effects of doing that better and more correctly, like, are just immeasurable.
Speaking of ripple effects, when we do think of the sheer number of people who have died in the pandemic, COVID deaths, those who died because they couldn't access care when hospitals were full, substance abuse related deaths, that has the ripple effect of just a huge part of the country actively grieving loss of friends and family.
What has that meant for the grief counseling industry?
Oh, that's such a good question. I can say that therapists, so social workers, mm-hmm. mental health providers, are swamped and overwhelmed. So there is huge pressure and huge demand for mental health support at a time when we've got people leaving the industry because of multiple reasons. And they're also swimming in this same sea and living through all of these losses. And then I think we're running up against the unfortunate reality here that most clinicians are not trained in really skillful, insightful ways to deal with grief, and certainly not grief on this scale. Mm. It's a really tricky moment for this industry.
When we talked before, we discussed sort of grieving the old economy, and then we never anticipated that we'd still be here. And I wonder what the consequences are of that, particularly as it relates to how well we are as a country processing that we probably aren't going back to the way things were.
Yeah. Outside of pandemic time, if we look at what very often happens for people grieving a death, the second year is when it starts to sort of settle in that, oh, this isn't changing. And it's about that time that the people around that grieving person start to sort of move on with their own lives. Like they get back to things mm-hmm. and they think that their grieving friend or family member should be all better by now. I think we're living in that as a culture. We can't tell ourselves in 6 months it's going to be better. Like we don't know that. And so it becomes more about how do we live with uncertainty in a way that feels connecting? And mm-hmm. what do we want to do to help ourselves live what we are being asked to live?
What are some strategies for that?
Well, one, I think the very first thing, and it sort of covers everything we've been talking about, is telling the truth. I think that my biggest problem with the ways that we've dealt with grief for decades is lying about it, right? Pretending we're okay when we're not. And it seems counterproductive or counterintuitive, like, wait a minute, I'm just supposed to say that things suck and then things will get better. Well, in a way, yes, right? Telling the truth about what we're struggling with lets us, one, like feel like we can connect with other people because we're not pretending to be something else. And two, when we know what's difficult, we can more accurately assess what can be changed, where we need more support, and where we need more connection.
Megan Devine is a psychotherapist and the author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome.
As Megan said, connection is essential. If you or someone you know is in distress right now, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. On top of all the loss and grief the pandemic has already caused, we're now confronting a record surge of new infections. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, more than 250,000 a day on average over the past week. That eclipses the previous record set last January, and the curve still points steeply upward as we head into year three of the pandemic. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman spent the day trying to get a sense of what impact that's likely to have on all of us, as consumers and as workers.
As a country, we are bummed and burned out by living with COVID death, disease, and disruption, and the prospect of a third year of pandemic.
Psychologically, we are definitely at a low point, and people just tell us in surveys they are tired, they just had enough of it.
Consumer psychologist Ayelet Fishback at the University of Chicago says this is partly about how long the pandemic's gone on, but even more important
is how long we still expect it to be. We are chasing this moving target, feel like you're not making progress and maybe you're even going back.
But this negativity and fear of the unpredictable pandemic is not translating into negative, fearful economic behavior. Repeated COVID waves haven't reversed the recovery of jobs and consumer spending. And Americans have gotten more resilient, says John Lear at polling firm Morning Consult.
while there is a lot of uncertainty about what the future of the virus holds, consumers and workers, they're growing more confident in the ability of this economy to chug along in the face of rising cases.
As Omicron is surging, layoffs aren't. The job market's rarely been better. Carl Van Horn at Rutgers University says when he surveyed workers during the Great Recession back in August 2010,
7% said it was a good time to get a job. In late November of 21, 76% said that was a good time to get a job. Okay. I mean, that's an enormous change.
Van Horn says workers have unprecedented leverage to change jobs, quit, and get new jobs. But for some, there's also unprecedented burnout, especially those on the front lines still caring for the sick and dying. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'm so worried about the future of the young generation.
Man, you and me both. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 90 points, a quarter percent, to close at 36,488. The NASDAQ gave up 15 points, a tenth of a percent, to end at 15,766. And the S&P 500 added 6 points, a tenth of a percent, to finish at 4,793. Checking in on some of those companies that stand to benefit from those New Year's resolutions Matt reported on, Peloton Interactive dropped 1 6/10%, Lululemon Athletic stretched 2/10% higher, and WW International, you might know it as Weight Watchers, lost 4%. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.55%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. The new year often brings new state laws and rule changes that kick in across the country. For example, in California, the state's Medicaid program, that's the public health insurance plan for people with low income, in 2022 will become one of the first in the country to cover preventative services that treat kids and their parents together. From KPCC, Mariana Dale reports.
Michelle Humphrey says when she became a mom, her relationship with the internet changed.
Honestly, like my Google searches from like before I had kids to after I had kids, it's just insane. It goes from like a recipe to like poop and like buts, and there's just so many things that nobody knows as a parent.
There were challenges she couldn't solve online. After her second child was born, the family downsized to a smaller home in the Southern California suburb of Temecula, and her older son Bowden's behavior changed dramatically. The then 3-year-old went from almost fully potty trained to having accidents.
He would have little bouts of like being aggressive, or he'd like hit, or he'd bit, or he'd like, you know, get frustrated and he couldn't like figure out what to do with his emotions.
Humphrey brought her concerns to Bella Lopez. She's a developmental specialist embedded in the family's pediatrician's office through a program called Healthy Steps.
A lot of the time, providers don't have the time to address other areas like, you know, mental health, development, the family system as a whole. And that's really kind of where I come into play.
Lopez listened to Humphrey's questions and connected her to a clinic that took Medicaid and offered therapy for parents and young kids. Humphrey says it's improved the relationship between her sons and helped Bowden get back on track developmentally.
I thought it was nice and made me feel like I almost like I have like an ally, like a liaison person to help me, you know, find answers that I can't find myself.
This Healthy Steps program is one of 200 nationwide. Research shows participating kids receive more preventative and developmental services and are more likely to get vaccines on schedule, among other benefits. Gina Johnson is the pediatric medical director for a group of clinics in Los Angeles County. She says early childhood is a critical time for intervention.
The social and emotional development that they go through in those first several months really literally transforms the architecture of their brain for their lives.
That organization, called Northeast Valley Health Corporation, piloted a program similar to Healthy Steps.
To have this family specialist whose whole purpose was to assess the needs that the family was experiencing and to connect them with the resources that they needed, philosophically, it's a no-brainer. That's what should be done always.
Despite the program's popularity, Northeast Valley wasn't able to sustain it after the grant funding ran out. That's because providers often can't bill insurance for the services these specialists provide.
And that's key because you need to be able to bill in order to support staffing.
Kate Margolis is a pediatric psychologist in San Francisco and helped push California to start paying for families with Medicaid to get connected to resources through a routine doctor's visit.
By providing those supports based on just the presence of risk, we really can get ahead of problems from getting worse.
It's an approach that can save the healthcare system money, but only if clinics can afford to offer it in the first place. In Los Angeles, I'm Mariana Dale for Marketplace.
As we wind down this year and look to the future, some folks are already worried the world isn't going to stick to climate resolutions. At last month's COP26 climate change conference, Japan was one of the countries that resisted demands for a quick end to burning coal, even though it has no coal reserves of its own and has pledged to reach net carbon zero by 2050. So what is Japan going to do? The BBC's Tokyo correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes visited a new Japanese coal plant to find out.
Takao Saiki is furious.
Well, I would say that's a total joke. You know, that's just ridiculous.
This usually mild-mannered septuagenarian is pointing at a giant construction site blocking our view of Tokyo Bay.
I'm totally against the burning fossil fuel because I'm so worried about the future of the young generation.
This plant is due to be completed in 2023. There are two others being built elsewhere in Japan. And these plants will carry on working for the next 40 years at least. So into the 2060s. So how exactly is Japan going to get its CO2 emissions to zero by the middle of the century when it's still building these coal-fired plants? The answer is hydrogen. In the future, these coal plants will be converted to run on hydrogen or ammonia. It's part of Japan's plan to become the world's first hydrogen society. At a filling station in central Tokyo, that's already happening. A shiny new Toyota car is being filled with hydrogen, and I'm going to drive it.
Toyota so far has not produced any battery electric vehicles. Instead, it is building this, the Mirai. And this is a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. It's a very different technology. So why does Toyota think that hydrogen is the future instead of batteries?
Elon Musk has described these hydrogen cars as stupid. Not surprisingly, perhaps, Hisashi Nakai from Toyota's public affairs division has a different view.
I know people have different opinions, but the important thing is realizing carbon neutrality.
In other words, Toyota sees a future where hydrogen fuel cells will be everywhere, in our homes, our offices, as well as our cars. But now, the really big question. Where will the hydrogen come from? The answer may surprise you.
I've now come 2 hours up the coast from Tokyo to a place called Hitachi Naka. And on the docks, there are two enormous coal carriers that are unloading their cargo from Indonesia and from Australia. Japan imports about 185 million tons of coal a year. The Japanese government knows it can't carry on doing this. So instead, it's come up with this strategy to convert the coal to hydrogen and ammonia in, for example, faraway Australia, and then to ship those over to Japan.
This is what the industry describes as blue hydrogen. Making it this way still produces lots of greenhouse gases. But Japan and Australia say they will be captured during the manufacturing process and buried in the ground.
And it will be very costly for the Japanese industry.
Professor Thomas Kayberger is an energy specialist at Chalmers University in Sweden. He says there is a big problem with Japan's blue hydrogen plan.
Using fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage will always be more expensive than using fossil fuels without carbon capture and storage.
In the last decade, the cost of producing electricity from renewable sources like solar and wind has fallen dramatically. But so far, just 10% of Japan's electricity comes from solar and less than 1% from wind. Instead, Japan appears to be committing itself to digging up coal for decades to come.
In Tokyo, I'm the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. I mentioned earlier in the show that new laws often kick in with the new year. Well, in 26 states, that means a pay bump for minimum wage workers. According to the research firm Wolters Kluwer, which compiled the list of increases, California will have the highest statewide minimum wage at $15 an hour, although it's $14 an hour for some smaller employers. Of course, with managers competing for workers in this economy, fewer places can recruit and retain employees with just minimum wage pay. Here's one more moment of economic context. The federal minimum wage is still $7.25 an hour, has been since 2009, although President Biden mandated federal workers and contractors start making at least $15 an hour next year. But according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2020, there were still over 1 million workers still making at or below the federal minimum wage. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squalacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.